a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a tea or a gin and tonic.
But not a toxin.
No, and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer. Sarah.
Carolyn.
We are doing another episode on The Big Bow Mystery by Israel Zangwill.
This is exciting. We really got kind of talking on some sidetracks last time.
We've been on a couple tangents, but I think they were worthwhile and valuable.
Yeah, that's why we read these books, folks. That's why you read great fiction.
Mm-hmm. It gets you thinking.
And tell me why else you picked this book.
I picked this book as one of our 12 books in our initial year, 2022. Because it's one of the earliest examples of a locked room mystery, and many people say that it's the first full-length locked room mystery. So, of course, we had Edgar Allan Poe's The Murders in the Rue Morgue, which is an amazing short story. It's the story that started our podcast, I think 1841. So this novel has two detectives who race to solve a murder. We have an innocent man who's condemned, and only at the very end, and I mean the very end, is the startling solution revealed. It's a page-turner, just like A Study in Scarlet, which was our last book. 3 to 4 hours tops, you can read this thing, and super funny, super interesting, a great twist for a locked room mystery, yeah. And I think good read.
Awesome. I love that you said what year it was. It made me think, like, in 2035, if you've just started listening to our podcast, yes, we did start way back in 2022.
Maybe I should be making these timeless. Like, it could be 2004 or it could be 2034.
No, nothing's timeless. We're reading in chronological order.
We are. We started in 1841. We're now 50 years into the future with this book, which is incredible if you think about it. We're really covering the Victorian era here. We're going to move into the Edwardian era as well. And as we wrap up this year, we have a whole new list that we're going to share with everyone really soon for 2023, because we know you want to get started on your reading.
Yeah. I do. I'm like ready to start picking out, but I hate not having it on hand and then having to wait for it when I want to be reading.
I'm always nervous that I'm going to have this like amazing amount of reading time that magically lands in my lap and then my books aren't here. And what do I do? Now this, to be fair, it has never happened. It's never once happened, but I'm worried about it.
Well, I don't even just like a wee bit of reading time. Like if I'm taking a bath and I don't have my next book, I'm like really bummed. I feel like I'm not optimizing my bath time.
Though the bath time is problematic because that's where you started The Big Bow Mystery a couple months ago.
It is. You can see a few wrinkles in it.
Yeah.
From some steam wrinkles.
Yeah. The book gets steamed sometimes. Every once in a while drops into the tub.
That's why I buy used books.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a little bit about our sponsor. We also have, I think, a listener award.
Yeah, we have a super sweet sponsor. That is Linden Botanicals. Colorado-based Linden Botanicals sells the world's healthiest teas and extracts. Their team has traveled the globe to find the herbs that offer the best science-based support for our immune health, stress relief, energy, memory, mood, kidney health, joint health, inflammation, and digestion. U.S. orders over $75 ship free. To learn more and get 15% off your first order, visit www.lindenbotanicals.com.
Love it.
Thanks for being our sponsor, Linden.
Yes, thank you for being our sponsor. And Sarah and I both enjoy the Linden Botanicals line of herbal teas and extracts.
We do, we do. And they're serious about like their global supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it that you get like your flagship tea?
Linden Botanicals gets the flagship teas from Peru, from Crete, several places in northern India, Mongolia, all around the world.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. I love it.
Yes. So let me tell you a little bit about the Big Bow Mystery in case you're behind your reading schedule, but you're caught up on your podcast listening. Big Bow Mystery. Okay. Locked Room Mystery, 1891 by Israel Zangwill. The story begins at the end of the 19th century in Bow, a working class district in London's East End. Mrs. Drabdump is a widow who rents out rooms, and one cold, foggy December morning, she tries to wake one of her lodgers, Arthur Constant. Constant is a philanthropist who has devoted his life to helping the working class and campaigning for workers' rights. Mrs. Drabdump bangs on his door, but he doesn't respond. The door is locked and bolted from the inside, and the key is in the keyhole. Fearing something's wrong, she summons her neighbor, retired Scotland Yard detective George Grodman. Grodman knocks down the door, and they find Constant dead in his bed with his throat cut ear to ear. The circumstances surrounding the case are puzzling. The door to the room and the windows were locked and bolted from the inside, making it impossible for the murderer to escape. The murder weapon's also missing. In addition, Constant had no enemies, so the motive is unknown. The coroner says it seems clear that the deceased did not commit suicide. It seems equally clear that the deceased was not murdered. Ooh. George Grodman and his arch-nemesis, Inspector Edward Wimp of Scotland Yard, both try to solve the mystery. They each have their own ideas about who killed Arthur Constant and how this perfect crime was committed. Grodman seems to suspect Denzel Cantercot, a freeloading poet and ghostwriter. Inspector Wimp, in turn, focuses on Arthur Constant's fellow lodger and friend, the union organizer Tom Mortlake. At the end, Tom Mortlake goes on trial for the murder of his friend. But did he really do it? And if he did, how is it to be proved? The unfolding drama even includes a cameo appearance by British statesman and liberal politician William Gladstone. In an introduction to one edition of the book, Dr. John Curran writes, "Here indeed was the perfect crime, the work of a mastermind. Can you solve the problem which baffled Scotland Yard?" And so we ask you, dear listener, can you solve the mystery? Who committed the crime? How did they do it and why? Don't worry, we will reveal all, but not just yet.
First, we want to acknowledge our listener of the episode.
Did I bypass our listener?
No, we're acknowledging her at just the right time.
Oh, that is amazing. I love when we do things at the right time.
It is Jennifer Z. Jennifer Z, we do not know where you are from. You are mysterious, just like our show. But if you get... We know you know our social, though. She has been liking things on the social media.
Yeah.
So reach out to us. We'll reach out to you, and we will send you a beautiful tea, tonic, and toxin sticker that you can stick wherever you would like.
They are very pretty stickers.
Yeah. They go well on water bottles, mm-hmm. books, laptops.
Coolers.
Coolers, that's where mine is.
All over your old vehicle that you just love to plaster with.
Yeah, people put stickers on cars and stuff.
Sure.
If you have a child, they'll stick it exactly where you don't want them to, mm-hmm. like your brand new cabinetry.
I'm assuming that this is hypothetical.
Totally hypothetical.
That's what I thought.
I know nothing about children and stickers.
Mm-hmm.
Sticking them places.
It seems like you would have no knowledge in this area.
No. Nope.
Jennifer Z, stay mysterious, but not so mysterious that we can't send you this sticker.
Toxin so, on!
Toxin on. Oh. And if you... listener would like your own tea tonic and toxin sticker. I'm thrown by the toxin on. I really am. It's
I can get worse, and they're going to get worse.
Oh, it's
going to
get worse.
Until you suggest some show wrapping lines.
So comment on our books, comment on the podcast, weigh in, say hello. Come up with a closing line that's maybe different than toxin on. And you too can win a sticker. You just have to visit us at www.teatonicandtoxin.com or at teatonicandtoxin on Instagram and Facebook.
Do it.
Please do it, because toxin on, man.
I don't know what to say. I'm doing all I can to just put words together here.
Yeah, we're doing what we can, but obviously we're tapped out here. So We need some outside help.
Please.
Sarah, we recently read The Mystery of a Hansom Cab.
It was Grodman! Grodman did it!
Sarah has been holding it together for an entire podcast episode, our first episode, where she refrained from saying the name of the murderer.
I was listening, I was like, well, it's almost like it's Goodman, but then he kind of mutated it. I was like, maybe that's because it's like, he's the detective, but he's not good. He's the murderer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're, I don't know how many minutes here.
As soon as I can fit it in, folks.
We're not 10 minutes in.
Exploding out of the corner here.
Grodman.
Really threw me for a loop. But then afterwards, I was like, well, I guess who else could have done it? It did have to be him after all.
It did. So I was going to talk Hansom Cab, but let's come back to that. And let's talk a little bit about Grodman, because here's the deal. Okay. We have these two rival detectives.
Oh, yeah. We got to talk about this.
Like, what's going on here?
The whole book, to me, even beyond the detectives, it was just, like, characterized by jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
You have your two rival detectives, but then you have, like, your two rival union workers.
Yeah.
Not union workers. Whatever you would call them.
Yeah. But, labor organizers.
Labor organizers. Yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah.
That kind of that plot depends on.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, well, they were rivals, and so it takes to, and then they kind of make them up to be rivals over the same girl, and,
yeah,
you know, but really, it was the rivalry over the detecting
mm-hmm.
that caused, like, the driving force of the book.
There was even some rivalry in the useful versus the beautiful, Crowell versus Cantercot.
Cantercot had his own internal rivalry there. He ended up being a bigamist. And I think he was trying to add a third with Jesse Diamond. He seemed clearly in love with her. Mm. You would have never known he had two other wives that he didn't care for that much.
Those were some of my favorite scenes. I'm just going to go on a tangent because we're really covering, like, immense amounts of ground. At the same time, we're covering almost nothing. So this is part of the joy of Tea, Tonic, and Toxin.
It's part of the joy.
He goes to Inspector Wim's house and ends up getting a sovereign and giving the sovereign to the maid.
Yes.
And then he goes to the other inspector's house. I'm sorry. He goes to, yes, Inspector Wim's. And then he also goes to Grodman's house.
Yeah.
Earns a sovereign. And then gives the sovereign to that maid, different woman.
Yeah.
At the time, I'm wondering, what is happening here?
And Grodman notices, but Wimp didn't notice. And I was trying to figure out, too, from the narrator's perspective, like, who's the better detective? Because when Wimp's talking,
yeah,
he's quite clever.
Yeah.
And Cantercot was kind of freaked out by how much he seemed to know intuitively.
Yes.
But his name was Wimp.
Yeah.
So I thought, why is his name Wimp?
I know. Yeah. It didn't seem fitting to me. It was a little confusing.
But he is the loser at the end.
He's the loser if in a murder case there is a winner.
Well, in this sort of competitive murder case, it seemed to me.
Yeah.
Where did you you had this quote in here that was really good about a whipped curve. Yes,
yeah,
here.
Yeah.
Oh, this. Oh my goodness. This whole scene when Wimp goes to arrest Tom Mortlake, and his whole deal, and they're both like this. Their whole deal is, how can I make this about me?
Yes.
Some poor soul, Arthur Constant, that everyone agrees was kind of a saint.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Crowell even wished there was a heaven for him to go to.
Yeah.
And they're unveiling the portrait that his poor fiance painted of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Gladstone is going to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, that's the moment that it is really a melodrama.
Where yeah.
He's like, Tom Mortlake, you're under arrest for the murder of Arthur.
That's a really weird timing.
Yeah. And then they both wanted to use the thing. And what does it say? Wimp had won.
Mm-hmm.
Grodman felt like a whipped cur.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did he win? I don't get that point, because then later I mean, Grodman knew Wimp was wrong.
Right, but Grodman was the only one who knew Wimp was wrong.
But he's like, did he win because he got the attention? Grodman wanted to use it to, like, arrest Crowell. Mm-hmm. Not Crowell, Cantercot.
Cantercot.
For bigamy.
Yes.
I thought he wanted to arrest him for murder, but then later he said bigamy.
So that's one of our red herrings, right? So there's not a huge cast of characters.
No.
And so we have to be led down a couple different paths so that we're, you know, thinking maybe this person did it, maybe this other person did it. And so Cantercot's a candidate because we know Grodman has his eye on him. And then Tom Mortlake's a candidate because Wimp has his eye on him.
Well, and Cantercot's a candidate because he tries to throw Mortlake under the bus with Wimp and is clearly in love with Mortlake's, like, fiance, who also might have had a crush on Arthur Constant.
And he's also trying to throw Grodman under the bus because he goes to Wimp instead of Grodman with this information.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, channeling all, you know, seeing that there's a rivalry here and trying to take advantage of it, leveraging the rivalry.
The rivalries were just so over the top. Mm-hmm. They were the driving forces in every kind of level of the book here.
Now, at the start of the book, I thought Tom Mortlake was a good candidate.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to pin him down. Where was he at this exact moment? Is he on the train? Is he not on the train? Is he on the second train? Is he... You know, it just seemed a little suspicious that he was outside the house, and I don't know.
Well, we never quite find out exactly, like, what he said to Arthur Constant.
Right.
Or, you know, what he was mad about, or if they were really fighting, or...
Mm-hmm. And then his fiancée is missing, Jessie Diamond.
Yeah.
The, you know, wonderfully named Jessie Diamond. She's the diamond in the rough because she's this amazing person, but he's getting maybe a little, you know, too well known. He's moving up in the world and she doesn't seem to fit the new Tom
Mortlake. She's a working class girl and he's getting invited to, like, parlor parties now.
Yeah, yeah. So at first I thought, okay, maybe Tom Mortlake did it.
Yeah. Well, and he certainly has some pride issues. Mm-hmm. Like when he's walking by Crowell's and Crowell invites him in. He's like, no, I'm in a hurry. Then Crowell gives him a jab. Like, he's too big for us now.
Yeah, and too cool for school.
Like, Tom doesn't like to be thought of as, like, not, like, kind of snubbing people in the working class now that he's kind of risen up. So that kind of twists his arm into coming in.
Yeah. And so we go down these different paths with the red herrings, and there's this concept of fair play in the book, which suggests that we should be able to figure it out because we know everything that the characters know. So let's talk for a second about murders in the Rue Morgue. I'm going to argue, and I think we argued back then, there's no way an average reader could figure out who committed that murder committed that murder.
Have any of the mysteries we've read so far up to this one been figure outable? I don't really think so.
Right, right.
Because we're always missing information.
We're missing key information that would tip us off.
Yeah. Maybe Bleak House?
No, I don't think so. No. No, because Hortense commits the
you
murder.
You should have already listened to that one.
You guys are all caught up, so no issue. Tulkinghorn is murdered by Hortense the maid, and it's really made to look as if Lady Dedlock committed the murder.
I mean, it is, but I think you could guess it was Hortense because it really talks about how she looks like she would have been in the French Revolution chopping off heads.
Sure. Yeah, I think she's a candidate for sure. Yeah. I mean, maybe she, you know, you might think she possibly committed the murder.
But other than that, I can't think of one where we've had enough information to just have made a good decision.
Right. So this is going to be a shift that we're going to increasingly see as we move through the Edwardian age and then into the 21st century, in particular into the golden age of detective stories. We are going to see more opportunities for fair play where the reader can potentially figure it out.
Yeah. I don't think we've read the definition yet.
No, but, please read it.
I liked it. And they said Zangwill actually introduced this idea. The indispensable condition of a good mystery is that it should be able and unable to be solved by the reader, and that the writer's solution should satisfy. Did you feel satisfied?
Yeah, I did. I liked the concept. I did overall feel satisfied. There came a point in the book where I instinctively knew what had to have happened.
Oh,
I
just really?
Yes, but I just wasn't sure how.
Interesting.
I wasn't sure how it had happened. And part of the reason I wasn't sure how is that I think the narrator really played games with the reader. I think that the narrator misdirects readers, meaning that readers are not on the same... the playing field's changed. So... ostensibly, we have the same clues as the characters. We learn Mrs. Drabdump entered Arthur Constant's room with her hands before her as if to ward off the dreadful vision. So she's already covering her own eyes. We know from the start, after Grodman bursts open the door, he spread a handkerchief over Constant's face. And you can see it as a sort of conjuring trick, like, you know, pay no attention over here, pay attention over here. And, but the narrator is all knowing and deliberately doesn't tell the reader a number of things. And when the narrator accesses various characters' thoughts, the narrator is really sort of suspect in what is revealed and what isn't. So, when Mrs. Drabdump runs across the street to Grodman's house because she thinks something must have happened to Arthur Constant, the narrator pops out of his window and he's having this conversation with her and he's in his dressing gown and so forth. And the narrator says he did not take this Cassandra of the kitchen too seriously. At no point in time does the narrator start cluing us in. And in fact, I'm going to argue the narrator pushes us the other direction. When Grodman arrives on the scene, he stood still, his face set and rigid, for he liked and esteemed the man. The narrator is, I think, if the narrator doesn't want to let us in because the surprise element is so worthwhile, the narrator shouldn't be misleading us either. The narrator shouldn't be leading us the other direction, where it seems to sort of exonerate or... I guess make it seem that Grodman is not guilty.
Yeah. Like, at the end, I didn't think it was Grodman. I was like, it doesn't seem like it could be anybody. I don't think it's any of these characters.
Right, right.
You know, yeah, in part, I think because, you know, looking back at that, I'm like, oh, well, he did talk about how much he liked and esteemed him. And it, like, you kind of really got the idea at the end that he was insane.
Yes.
Like the way
totally.
That he was describing, like the connection between him and Constant. And so he just, like, he knew this was going to be the guy he's going to kill because he likes him so much. And they just had such a great connection that, you know, he was going to murder him. He just had to plot it out.
Well, so Inspector Lake had that entire theory where, you know, Tom Mortlake did it. The key was on the ground. The bolt, you know, was broken or what have you. And because the door was burst open by Grodman, they didn't know that these things were the case. So that enabled the room to be entered and, you know, exited by Tom Mortlake, the murderer, and entered by Grodman.
Oh, Wimp was hilarious. He even, like, took up a room in the house and, like, disguised himself as a boarder so he could search Mortlake's room. And that was the thing that really, like, threw Grodman, was that there ended up being, like, kind of a probable cause against Mortlake. And there was a whole... I think the judge even pointed out, like, hey, this is the only guy that there's even a motive for.
Yeah. Don't have any idea how he did it, but who else is there?
All of what he's saying is plausible, and there's certainly no better theory out there.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious, because that's the whole reason Grodman turned himself in at the end, was not because an innocent man was about to be hung.
Right.
It was that he didn't want it to seem like Wimp solved the murder.
Yes. The rivalry reared its ugly head.
I think that was one of my questions is like, because this is such a rivalry, jealousy book.
Yeah.
Do you have any rivals? Who are you rivals? Who are they?
Like, professional rivals?
It seems, I mean, I'll let you answer the question, but in this particular instance, it's like, the rival is the person that's similar to you.
Mm-hmm.
But
who ostensibly performs a similar function.
Yeah, you've got your labor organizer rivals, you've got your maid wife rivals, you've got your detective rivals, you've got levels here.
Yeah.
Do you have any rivals?
I don't know. I don't know that I have a specific rival so much as, you know, in my business, I, you know, work on marketing for companies, and I know we've discussed this even in this podcast before, but I often come in and see what my competition has done for the client, and I'm horrified by it. And then I hear how much money the client has paid that other marketing resource to do this terrible work. And so I guess in some senses, there's a rivalry there where I just want to, you know, wave the tallest, biggest flag in the world and just say, like, quit throwing money at terrible. But I don't think an actual individual person I'm a rival with anyone. How about you? Are you somebody's rival?
Well, what I thought of, so I have these houses right now I call my enemy houses.
Okay.
And I think we have discussed in this podcast lately the trouble we had getting our house built over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So any kind of house in the vicinity that has been built from scratch and has like a yard now and has been sold and in some cases resold second time while ours was still like struggling and floundering. I'm like, oh, they're my enemy houses.
Screw you, enemy homeowner.
I didn't do anything. It's very, I guess, unpersonal, but it sure is a source of grumpiness.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there can be, we can have jealousies and things like that. You know, somebody has something that we want, whether it's lifestyle or progression or a house or whatever the thing is. But the rivalry seems like an active thing. So, like, the two detectives are actively trying to win the case. And we see this even in Mystery of a Hansom Cab, where, like, the detectives are each sort of trying to make their case and be the detective that solves the crime. And to me, in both of these books, it's more important than actually like doing the right thing or wanting to find the criminal. Yeah, it's
way more important. There's a couple of showboats.
Yeah. It's not about like, I want to solve the crime and get this murderer off the street. It's like, I want to solve the crime and then it'll all be about me.
Yeah. I want to solve it dramatically. I want to have this drama. It's weird that Grodman even wanted to arrest, you know, Cantercot. He's retired, dude.
Yeah.
Like, what are you going out running around arresting people? You're not a police officer anymore.
But retirement, so this gets into retirement, right? Like, you are this, you know, renowned inspector with Scotland Yard. You retire, you live this quiet life, and suddenly the spotlight's not on you anymore. You know, retirement can be tough, right? If you don't have something mapped out how you're going to spend your day. So it seems Grodman had a little too much time on his hands and did not like being so far outside the spotlight.
This is serious, folks. You need to get a hobby.
Yeah,
because you may become a murderer.
You could start just murdering someone just for the heck of it to have an activity.
Yeah, in kind of a way, he sounds a little Sherlock Holmesy. Like, none of these criminals are really any good.
Right.
Sherlock Holmes is like, there's no real crime anymore for me to solve.
Because he's written this book, right? Like this, I can't remember the name of the book. It's this all-encompassing Criminals.
Criminals I Have Caught.
Criminals I Have Caught. I'm sorry, he hasn't written it. Denzel Cantercot, the ghostwriter, wrote it.
Yeah.
But Criminals I've Caught, and it's gone through multiple editions, and since Arthur Constant's murder, it went through another edition. And so, you know, his name gets back into the press every time this book comes back out. But the word I, the ego in that title of the book, it's that I have caught. It's you could see how living a retired life, a quiet, unassuming life in Bow, would maybe not suit this guy.
Yeah, he was so funny, too. He said, like, oh, I realized I, like, forgot to get married.
Yes.
It's too late now, so I took up murder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, the other aspects of many people's lives, he have bypassed him, or he has bypassed. And so now he's left in this position where, you know, being the world's foremost criminologist and ultimately criminal.
Mm-hmm.
So we think at the end, Tom Mortlake's going to get, you know, he's, you know, going to be hung, right? He's.
Yeah, they really go down to the wire. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an interesting aspect, trying to get him off the hook and trying to find Jesse Diamond. And
yeah, his fiance is missing. And she's the one who can clear him if she says, yeah, he was with me. So another, you know.
But actually, I don't think she was with him. I was kind of confused. Like, well, how do you know she can even clear him? She left. He still could have killed Constant and she would know about it.
I need to go back and read that part. But I thought it was because she could account for, she gave him an alibi.
I thought it was just that she could explain what was going on with Constant, or like vouch that Tom didn't kill her. Because he got the letter too. It was dated 2 weeks after she left.
Okay.
So she was already long gone.
Yeah.
I don't think she was an alibi because they like never came to see her.
Mm-hmm.
But something, and maybe this is a weak spot in the book, but they expected that if they could find her, she could shed some light at least on what passed between her and Constant.
Right.
If it was kill worthy or not, I guess.
Kill worthy. Yeah. So would he have killed for this relationship?
Mm-hmm.
And in Mystery of a Hansom Cab, Sal Rollins shows up just in time to save Brian Fitzgerald, who's about to be guilty.
These missing ladies.
Yeah, these ladies come in and save the day. But we don't know. This is one piece of information the reader doesn't know at the end until the Home Secretary tells us. So, Sarah, can you walk us through like what happens at the end of this book? Because you've been aching to talk about Rodman.
Yeah,
he walks.
Grodman
shows up.
Like comes in and they're cheering him like Grodman, because it's like the ninth hour, getting ready to hang Tom Mortlake. Mm-hmm. Walks in and there's just kind of a passing mention of a telegram or something.
Yeah,
and Grodman walks in and is like, "Get ready to take shorthand. I'm gonna tell you."
Yes,
and he kind of explains that he's the one that wrote this letter earlier in the book, saying it had to be. Mm-hmm. Drab Dumper himself.
Yeah.
And then they're like, Drab Dump? And they're like, no, stupid. How would you even suspect her? Oh my goodness, it's
okay,
me.
That would have been amazing, by the way. I mean, I would have like started the entire book again from page one if it had been Mrs. Drab Dump.
No, yeah, he gets so frustrated. And then he starts telling about how it was him. And I was like, really? And it took me a minute to kind of get in, and I was like, oh, okay, you did do this, how weird.
Yeah.
And then at the end the secretary's like, all right, did you get that confession? We were gonna commute the sentence anyway.
Yes.
Because the telegram said Jesse Diamond has been located.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he doesn't want Wimp to get the credit for arresting Tom, figuring out it was Tom, arresting Tom, and then Tom being hung.
Yeah, he didn't mind Tom being hung, so long as Wimp wasn't the solver of the crime.
Right. So to prevent Wimp from being named the, you know, best detective in all of England, Grodman decides he's just going to tell the truth. Yes. And the truth is probably the only thing that legitimately could have possibly happened.
Yeah.
Which is that Grodman did it. So,
I mean, Tom could have done it. But The way the book's written, you're kind of like, well, I don't think it was him, or you wouldn't write it this way.
Right. So if Tom had done it, then we get back into the key being in the keyhole and all the other stuff. How did he get out of that room? And we hear at the very beginning of the story, the key is in the keyhole, for example. Mm. Like, they look, Drabdump or Grodman look through the keyhole and they see the key in it. So the question is, how would Tom have gotten out? And so in a locked room mystery, you know, we'll see variations on this going forward, but it's got to be somebody in the room. Well, somebody in the room was Grodman and Mrs. Drabdump. I mean,
yeah,
it's the Pell, one of the mystery writer who ends up being Grodman wrote to the Pell Mell Press. It has to have been Grodman or Mrs. Drabdump. Yeah. Like, ding, ding, ding. You know, yes, it does. And so how is it done?
Yeah, that's a crazy. He wasn't dead. He was alive.
Yes,
he and was Grodman killed him soundly. When he busted down the door.
So Grodman the night before had given him some sort of sleeping potion,
mm-hmm.
and Arthur Constance sleeping soundly. Drabdump and Grodman come into the room, and then the scene is set for this murder to be able to take place very quickly under Mrs. Drabdump's eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting part here. Mm-hmm. The eye sees what it expects to see.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, he kind of went on, you know. Drabdump was already suspect. His name's Arthur Constant. Mm-hmm. He was very regular in his habits.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so as he suspected, the only reason he wouldn't be up is because he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's kind of portrayed as this woman who's given to maybe a dramatic turn or
right.
kind of a worrywart or something.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of says a lot about it. But she expected he was dead, so she, like, hid her face,
mm-hmm.
even though he was just alive, sleeping soundly.
Right. So she had already built it up in her mind that something serious was going on. She was calling for him. She was knocking on the door. He was always up at a certain time. He had a meeting, the tram workers meeting he was supposed to go to. So she's already, like, her anxiety is through the roof. She gets Grodman. He comes over, knocks down the door. So her, like, expectation is that on the other side of the door is something foul, like murder. It has to have been death or murder or something. And Grodman says, he tells the Home Secretary, people go through life without eyes and their observation and judgment are impaired by irrelevant prejudices. He says, Mrs. Drabdump, like most women, would cry murder. She habitually takes her prepossessions for facts, her inferences for observations. The key to the Big Bow mystery is feminine psychology.
You got to get a knock on women in there somewhere.
Yeah, in most of the books we've read, the authors have found a really good way to get some sort of knock on women in there.
Whether you say it's feminine psychology or whether you say it's like he kind of knew how Mrs. Drabdump would behave.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot that's in here that's probably quite true. I liked, you kind of quoted some of the parts at the beginning here,
mm-hmm.
that the suspiciously precise recollection of dates and events possessed mm-hmm. by ordinary witnesses in important trials taking place mm-hmm. years after the occurrences involved is one of the most amazing things
in
the curiosities of modern jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm.
I defy you to tell me what you had for dinner last Monday, or what exactly you were saying and doing at 5 o'clock last Tuesday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about that and I couldn't at all. It's completely true.
It's so true. And there's this podcast that a lot of people are in on now.
Is it Teatonic and Toxin?
Well, that is definitely one of them. Teatonic and Toxin, amazing. But it's called Serial. And their first season was on this guy, Adnan Syed, who was accused of murder. And so it's a true life story and an investigation that the podcaster journalist leads, and she starts in episode 1 by saying, she has to go back in time and interview various people about where they were on a random Friday afternoon at high school, you know, at after school. So say it's at 4 p.m. And where were you, you know, 10 years ago on Friday, February 3rd at 4 p.m.? And
absolutely no telling.
And it's impossible to know. You know, if you watch an episode of Law and Order, you know, the detectives go to the door and, you know, where were you last Wednesday at 2? And, you know, the person, as they're pouring tea, you know, they're all sitting in a lovely, perfectly kept, non-cluttered sitting room. The, you know, woman or man is pouring tea and they're like, 2 o'clock. Well, I was just leaving my appointment with the... They always know. Like, it's very rare in an episode of Law and Order for somebody to say, God, I don't know what I did yesterday, let alone last Tuesday. But in Serial, in the Adnan Syed story, you know, it starts with, it's so hard to recollect what we even did last week.
Yeah, or yesterday.
Yeah.
Or, what did you have for dinner on Saturday? Last Saturday?
Last Saturday? Woo-hoo! That is an amazing question. I don't remember even one thing about last Saturday.
What did I do? I think we were building closets. what did I have for dinner? No, wait, I don't know.
I have no idea.
Oh, we were supposed to have a Friendsgiving, but it got canceled.
Mm.
So I must have had a leftover.
Mm.
What leftover, Carolyn?
I don't know.
I don't know. But the next part was super true also, and I liked that kind of level he went down.
Mm-hmm.
The first time we meet a man, we may possibly see him as he is. Mm-hmm. I would argue no. The second time, our vision is colored and modified by the memory of the first.
Yeah.
Do our friends appear to us as they appear to strangers? No. Do our rooms, our furniture, our pipes strike our eyes? They would strike the eye of an outsider looking on them for the first time? And then finally, which I think is the question of questions,
mm-hmm.
can we see ourselves as others sees us?
Mm-hmm.
The eye sees what it expects to see.
Yeah. Yeah. We certainly don't see ourselves, our friends, and our rooms the way somebody else would see them.
No way.
Mm-mm.
Now, my favorite book about that, I think it's called Through the Glass Darkly.
Mm-hmm.
It ends up, it is, you don't think it is, but then at the end you realize, oh, this is a book about self-perception.
Aha. Okay.
And it's really, it's just really brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
It's brilliant. But
I've had this theory, and I've written about this in fiction at times, where in families, for example, you are fill in the blank. These say three adjectives that describe you, that your family might use to describe you. And no matter what happens to you after you are so labeled, you will always be those things.
Yes.
And
they will never see you a different way.
A different way. And in the workplace too. I actually wrote about this, blogged about this recently, and then, you know, posted on my business pages, but about what is your superpower, because it's easy to get pigeonholed in doing one thing and then suddenly that's who you are. But you do these other 10 things, but maybe your clients or your boss don't know that you do those things, or they kind of have an inkling you might know something about that, but they don't understand your level of expertise. Mm-hmm. It's easy for us to look at other people, and it's sort of self-preservation. We label them in particular ways in order to understand them, because when we have that foundational understanding, we can springboard off that and start drawing conclusions and making decisions and all the other things that are necessary once we think we know something about someone. The danger is when we think we know something about someone is that understanding may be true at the time or may not. And it's a fluid thing. So it doesn't mean that what was true this one day is true 2 years, 5 years, 10 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is, There's a lot, you know? I don't think even the first time you meet a person, you see them as they are. Mm-hmm. You just see them without context. Yeah. It's not necessarily as they are.
Right.
But yeah, you kind of grow your context as you go along, but then sometimes it seems like your context stops growing. It gets stuck at a point, and you're not taking in new context.
Yeah. It's complicated stuff. I find it really interesting, in particular, the way we, even when presented with new information, often can't see beyond, I'll just even say for myself, but all of us, can't see beyond what we think we know about someone or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're locked in. We don't really see.
Yeah. You're sort of interpreting almost everything in kind of the light of the framework you've built.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I catch myself doing that. I'm like, that's maybe not fair.
Yeah. Yeah. Ascribing, you know, behaviors and thoughts to people is always dangerous. It's hard enough to really truly understand our own thoughts and motivations, but we're not in other people's heads. But I think we can sometimes think that we are because we know so much about whoever the person is. And I think it's really dangerous.
Yeah, it can, you know, you think somebody's a bozo, they do something and you're like, what a bozo thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it was, but it goes the other way too. You know, see this happen a lot. I noticed in grad school, you know, folks will be, you know, all these PhDs, professor types walking around, and you get this label of, oh, well, you're really smart.
Mm-hmm.
So everything you say and think must be really smart.
Yeah.
But that's not true.
Right. And, yeah, and so then we could potentially put in question everything we're thinking or saying because, well, the smart person thinks otherwise sort of thing. And so...
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you should do that, but not always.
Right. I think it's... you know, people often don't know what they don't know. So having a healthy understanding of your strengths and weaknesses, understanding your own limitations, I think is great. I know, generally speaking, what my wheelhouse is, and I know the areas where I falter. And that helps me speak confidently about the things that I know and be really honest about the things that I have ideas about, but maybe don't know as well. In the case of this book, Grodman, the criminal mastermind, takes advantage of his understanding of psychology here.
Yeah.
And knows that this murder is going to work.
Well, and he takes advantage of, too, of like, he's the detective.
Mm-hmm.
He's already kind of in the slot of good guy, mystery solver, criminal finder.
Yeah.
And so that's what people go to him for. They're not expecting him to be the murderer.
Right. In fact, the Home Secretary immediately jumps to Mrs. Drabdump must have done it if it was someone in the room.
Yeah. Yeah. And
Mrs. Drabdump. which, again, if it had been her, I would have started that book right over from page one and been like, this book is amazing. It's a very good book. But if Mrs. Drabdump had done it, amazing.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And at this time period, too, I've noticed, like, detectives seem to have just unlimited license.
Yeah.
You don't need a warrant.
Yeah.
You can just disguise yourself and search people's rooms every night.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You can trick people into giving stuff away. You can post stuff in newspapers.
Yeah.
You can break into their house. You know, if you're like in good guy category, you can basically do whatever you want to solve the mystery. And it's, well, you can see why a lot more laws developed along those lines.
When this, when Big Bow Mystery was published, it was published in serial form. And so it allowed Israel Zangwill, the author, to engage in conversations with readers who were writing in letters to the editor.
Yeah.
And so one writer that I was reading was saying that this might have been the, you know, equivalent of like a Twitter exchange or something like that, or, you know, a radio call-in show where people are calling in with, you know, what they think happened and who they think did it. And this must be the solution. And, you know, I think that's an interesting way to go about it, to build up that interest, because everybody wants to solve it. Kind of like, I don't know if you watched the however many seasons, 8 seasons of Lost. No. 6 seasons, 8 seasons.
My parents did, though.
But yeah, I watched that show, and everybody had their own ideas about how this series was going to end, what was really going on in the series, and so forth. And it's like people are engaged in, like, they're emotionally connected to the story because they want to know, and because they think they might know, you know. And the same thing's happening here in Big Bow, where people, like, what's going to happen? You know, who did it? How did they do it? And he does it in a very different way than Edgar Allan Poe. There's no orangutan working this weird, like, mysterious, you know, series of actions or anything like that. And so let's maybe, you know, just close this out by talking briefly about the crazy man. Like, even though I knew it had to be him, at some point midway, I kept thinking we were going to get some window of insight into what was going on. Mm-hmm. It didn't occur to me that the motive was just so crazy. Like, because I can. Well, he was as good a candidate as any, and what a nice guy.
Bored in retirement.
Yeah, like,
I had no wife. I had no hobbies.
Were you thrown by that?
Like, I was. At the beginning, I was like, this is totally made up. And then my mind went to, like, oh, well, he went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But, I mean, you think about it. Mm-hmm. And both him, and if you think about Wimp as being like a young him, mm-hmm. to a certain extent, they were both just so motivated by credit.
Yeah.
Getting the credit and getting the praise.
Yeah.
You know? And so if Wimp's that way, mm-hmm. causing his huge melodrama at, like, this commemoration of a good man.
Yeah.
And, like, it's like just stealing the show and... Well, what is Grodman like, man? He's had a whole career, mm-hmm. of doing that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think probably they're both a couple of psychopathic type people.
Yes, you know,
it's not about, mm-hmm. doing right. It's about, and, you know, sad to say, you do see some people in these types of careers who just kind of want... a legal way to use force, or they get to, like, do this and be called the good guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I want to carry a gun. What's the easiest way to legit do that? Well, I'm, you know, going to become, you know, a law.
Going into law enforcement.
We're not saying that's the norm.
No.
Not by far, but.
These are clearly a couple of.
Yeah.
Very unusual characters, very smart, mm-hmm. but also very motivated, mm-hmm. by, like, credit and praise and accolades. And mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, part of the challenge, as I already mentioned, is not having an identified protagonist in the book. Is I wasn't sure who I was supposed to be identifying with. I wasn't sure whose journey I was following. Mm-hmm. You know, am I supposed to be, like, freaked out that Tom Mortlake might be hung? Am I supposed to be freaked out that Grodman hasn't solved the case yet? You know, I wasn't sure where I was supposed to be, or where, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, now I can see that that's, you know, by design, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny that Grodman wasn't actually trying to solve the case. He was just trying to actually make it unsolvable again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
Well, it wasn't Tom Mortlake. We've got him off the hook, but we still don't have a candidate.
Right. And, you know, if Zangwill had gone one step further and told us the story from Grodman's point of view, we would have had an author preceding Agatha Christie by... a lot of years. Mm,
yeah. It did remind me of that a little bit.
Yeah, we'll get into that in year two, which
I'm pretty excited about.
It was last November, a year ago, that we were really just mapping out this podcast and this book club that we have launched. I don't even know that we had a name for it yet back in November. Maybe we did.
I don't know, when we were just, like, brainstorming. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of good ideas, like we also have about closing lines.
Mm-hmm. Closing, yeah. I mean,
throwing words together over here.
Toxin on.
Stay mysterious.
Stay mysterious. Yeah, I mean,
continue making tea. Yes, getting better.
And and gin and tonic, but not a toxin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now we're clearly not there yet with the closing line. Oh, stay mysterious is my favorite.
Stay mysterious.
Stay mysterious.
Are you even yes, you are. Yes. If you're listening to this podcast.
Wait, weigh in, people, because we need some help here. We are really struggling. I mean, is stay mysterious where we want to land? Do we want something different? You got to help us out here because we're at a bit of a loss. So
go on the social media and write some stuff.
Write some stuff. Share some thoughts. At Teatonic and Toxin, teatonicandtoxin.com. All the while, stay mysterious.
Yeah. We'll come up with an even better mystery gift to be revealed than a sticker.
Yeah, this is a prize big one.
If so you win.
You always, when we give a prize, you always get a sticker, but we might go bigger with this one because we really need some help with this, and we want to close strong.
Go forth and tonic.
Go forth and toxin. Not good in the world. We're going to work on this with your help, Lisa.
I'm going to make it worse and worse to motivate you submit.
Yeah, and I didn't think there was anything worse than toxin on, but here we are.
Yeah.
Go forth and toxin.
I've got a limitless depth.
Thank you, listeners. Let's talk about it quickly.
Yeah, our next book.
What is our next book?
I think it's another Sherlock Holmes, isn't it?
Oh my goodness, it is.
The Hound of the Baskervilles. This one was chosen because of Sherlock Holmes, of course, who we met for the first time in A Study in Scarlet. And now we'll discuss The Hound of the Baskervilles. This gothic-inspired spine-tingler includes a spectral hound and a decidedly hands-off Sherlock Holmes. Published in 1902, it's commonly considered Arthur Conan Doyle's best.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
It's estimated to take about 4 hours to read the book. I think I always take longer.
You and I are taking notes. We're really focused on like students of the book sort of thing.
I'm always underlining.
I'm underlining a lot.
I like take my pen to the bath. Mm-hmm. I kid you not. If I'm taking a bath about a pen, I'm so frustrated with myself. Buy a copy on Amazon, eBay, mm-hmm. used bookstore, or read for free from Project Gutenberg.
Gutenberg.org. We think it's one of the most gripping and suspenseful murder mysteries ever written.
Let us know what you think.
We want to hear what you think.
Go forth and toxin.